Thank you for joining me on MS and Sex. My goal on this podcast is to empower people to find their own path to sexual fulfillment, regardless of their health or disability status. But I also want to reach the practitioners who serve folks with chronic conditions. Talking about sex, relationships, and kink can be awkward in a clinical setting. And through this podcast, the Q&As, and classes, I strive to offer information that will support you as you address the health and well-being of your patients in a holistic and sex-positive manner. Now, I don't shy away from subjects that many people find uncomfortable. So, get ready. Don't flinch. On today's episode, I'll talk with a researcher about the kink bias that some patients face from mental health care workers and the lack of support that those practitioners face as they strive to provide good mental health care. As a patient, the experience of trying to address your alternative sexuality choices with a mental health or medical practitioner can be stressful and even harmful. Or the efforts to hide your activities can be frustrating and stressful in its own way. But from a practitioner's perspective, I know that talking about these issues in a clinical setting can feel uncomfortable or even triggering. I know that you're in this field because you want to help people, and more critically, to do no harm. As we will talk about in this episode, everyone holds bias. It's normal. The best thing that we can do is learn to recognize it, decide if it's something we're ready to look at, and to shift. But if it's just more than you as a practitioner can deal with, is this a client that you need to refer to someone else? So I recently sat in on a presentation by some researchers from Saybrook University. One of the graduate students realized that despite the recent focus on various forms of implicit bias training, there was absolutely no scale for mental health care practitioners to gauge their bias regarding kink. So, let's dive in to learn about their work and why it is so important. Dr. Vanessa Brown, thank you so much for joining us today on MS and Sex. Dr. Brown is an associate chair of the Humanistic Psychology Department at Saybrook University. So can you tell me, Dr. Brown, what gender pronouns you prefer and what else you think is important for people to know about you?
Yeah, thank you. I prefer she, her pronouns. And I'm over here in Michigan. That's where I'm calling from. I used to be an adjunct professor at Michigan School of Psychology, and now I'm over the associate chair of clinical psychology at Saybrook University. And I'm also a psychotherapist in the Detroit, Michigan area.
I would like you first, I want to start off with getting you to tell me and my listeners what the difference is between psychology and humanistic psychology.
That's a wonderful question. So psychology is an umbrella term referencing our occupation. But humanistic psychology is really about seeing the person beyond what their symptoms are. So we tend to believe that people are not just reduced to individual parts of themselves. You are beyond your symptoms. You're beyond any individual identity. And that we have to hold people in context, in their own specific context, where they, what kind of experiences or wisdom they're bringing into the session. And also a belief that individuals have an inherent potential to grow. You do not need a therapist in order to have movement in your life. And so you're beyond even the wisdom of someone else. That's inherent within yourself.
That's really important. And to me, it's almost surprising that that's not a given.
Well, the medical model had a lot to do with that. If we look at the history of psychology, there was an attempt to be equivalent to the medical field. And so because of that, just like the medical field would look like, oh, okay, you have a broken arm, let's fix your broken arm. Psychologists had to do that to try to get insurance benefits and to be taken seriously as a scientific field. And so we started to identify what is your symptoms and how can we fix those. And so we saw fields like behaviorism or cognitive behavioral therapy pop up, which are more symptom-oriented types of psychology.
let's dive into why you're here. I heard you talk about a study that you were a part of creating with some other people, and I'm sure you'll talk about those folks too. But just tell me about the origins of this study.
Yeah, so one of my students, Lexi Gerd, brought an idea to me and said, do you think that therapists are competent when it comes to kink? Because it seems like there are many therapists who are shaming clients for their kink behaviors, specifically believing that they come from a previous trauma that the individual had experienced or that they were traumatizing the client right now. And they wanted to study that.
I want to clarify here that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM, long categorized most activities practiced by kink, leather, and alternative sexuality communities as paraphilic disorders. Now, this is a condition that requires psychological and/or medical intervention. So let's first define a paraphilia. And this is from a dictionary, the Oxford Dictionary definition.
A condition characterized by abnormal sexual desires, typically involving extreme or dangerous behaviors.
Now, this diagnosis has historically had dire consequences. This includes, but is not limited to, custody battles, leading to situations where folks who practice ethical and consensual kink have lost custody of their children. This is horrifying. Now, in 2013, the DSM-5 was published, and it explicitly stated that practicing or fantasizing about BDSM does not automatically constitute a paraphilic disorder. In the book Erotic Subjects and Outlaws, the author Nick Moulet writes that the recent changes to the DSM do not go far enough. They state that there are still several activities that are pathologized without the scientific evidence to back up these claims. They argue that
the American Psychological Association should end its conflation of BDSM with pathology by removing all forms of paraphilic and fetishistic behaviors from the DSM, as the inappropriate use of such is already addressed by the law.
Now, what happens in psychology is, as a student, oftentimes it's hard to do your own research. You frequently have to have a faculty member as your chair in order to get what's called institutional review board approval. And so that was a study that I was interested in just because of my beliefs in humanistic psychology that, yes, of course, someone is beyond what those behaviors are, and that those behaviors could be really positive for an individual. And so that was a study that myself and Lexi decided that we were going to try to dive into. So we built a team. And so together, we started trying to research kink behaviors just in general. What kind of information is out there right now for psychologists and therapists? And what we found was that there is a prevalence of stigma related to this. What was coming up over and over again was this idea of trauma at the root of kink behaviors, and many, many articles beginning to challenge that. So there's a difference between what the science is showing, which is that there is not a higher rate of trauma amidst kink practitioners, and yet that's not being translated into practice, that therapists are still believing that there's trauma at the root of that. And so that got us wanting to know, how can we study what the competence level is of practitioners, of psychologists and therapists out there? Now, there's plenty of other studies. Harvard does a wonderful job with their implicit bias series. They have many, many different ones about sexual orientation, race, gender. There's just a lot of implicit bias studies, but kink is not on there. So we identified that that was an area that we need to have some cultural competence scales related to the kink community, so that practitioners can examine themselves and understand where their biases lay. And so that's where we started to pull together the literature to create a scale. And we're in the process right now of norming it. And then eventually that will become publicly free source available.
That is so exciting to me and so important. I found it interesting that you all started out one direction and you're like, wait a minute, there's not even a scale out there. That's how to address this. And if you're anyone that has ever gone to any kind of practitioner for assistance and help, and you are a kinkster, you have felt that. And so that's really, there are two groups of people that I really would love to hear this podcast. And one are the patients. And if they have any kind of alternative sexuality behavior that they engage in, I want them to hear it. And I want them to learn that it's okay for them to expect to be accepted. Mm-hmm. And then also, very importantly, I want people that are in the medical field to hear this, to begin thinking about this. I want to ask you, what do you think it would take for your research to be extrapolated out to be helpful for medical practitioners?
Yeah, as I was saying before the interview, I feel like sometimes there's a gatekeeping wall that happens in the medical community. And that is experienced even by psychologists. So frequently, when we try to collaborate with medical professionals, we are put off, send me a letter instead of communicating with me. And is my letter even read? I've had many clients that I've written a letter saying, these are some issues that I would recommend as a psychologist that you might want to examine as a physician. And the letter is not written, is not read. It's put in a file somewhere and charted, but not actually brought into practice. And so there's a difficulty for me as a psychologist to know how to push through that gatekeeping that happens, that wall that occurs with the medical community where other professions are not viewed as scientific enough or knowledgeable enough or competent enough when it comes to medical needs. However, there's study after study that has shown that psychological needs overlap with medical needs. And I'm sure you've seen that in your work with individuals who have disabilities or chronic conditions.
Just because some of the listeners might not really understand what we're talking about when we talk about implicit bias and scales for implicit, can you talk a little bit more about that and what those are and why they're important?
So everybody holds implicit bias. And what that means is that there are automatic gut reactions that you have to other people's identities. If you think about when you come into a room and you see someone and they've got a face like this, your implicit bias says, oh, that person might be angry. Maybe they're not safe. Okay, so evolutionarily, we develop those in order to create a sense of safety, to move through the world, not having to examine every single decision that we make. So it's important to know that implicit bias is inherent. Everybody is going to have them. It's not if you do or don't. So I think that's, I want everybody to really understand that. The goal is not to not have implicit bias. It's to bring it more to the surface so that you're aware of when it's happening and make an action that is an informed action, rather than a gut automatic reaction. So if you had an implicit bias for someone who was a Black man, for example, we know that a common implicit bias is the assumption that that person might be threatening. So we see people who, shift to the other side of the street or clutch their purse a little bit. Sure, now that's an extreme example, right? But we want that to come to the surface. So instead of just automatically doing that, you are saying, I am doing that because of my assumptions about that individual. And I acknowledge they might not be true. So how do I want to proceed now? Do I want to continue to make this choice to cross the street? Or do I want to engage with that person and see if I can challenge my bias? So therapists, what we are calling them to do is we're calling them to be aware of what their bias is so that when they encounter a client or a patient that comes into their office, that they're not treating them based on an automatic or gut reaction. They're treating them with an informed reaction. They're understanding why they might believe something about that client without all of the information to back it up.
When you started this study, one of the first things that you presented to people that were participating in your study was something called a Comfy with Kink scale. So I want you to talk to folks about
that. Our Comfy with Kink scale, which we named so lovingly, was created by Lexi, the founder of the study. Comfy with Kink is a list of sexual behaviors to check in with yourself about what you are comfortable talking about your clients or your patients with. And clients could even examine, am I comfortable talking to my physician or my therapist about these behaviors? And so they range from sexual sexual education, for example, are you comfortable asking your doctor or your therapist questions about sex education? For example, wanting to know the side effects of a birth control that you might be on, that would fall under sexual education. But they progressively get more out of the ordinary. So that would be a common question you would want to ask your physician, is a side effect of a medication. Less common would be to talk to your doctor about ways to navigate consent if you are someone who's into mummification as a kink behavior. And so are you comfortable as a therapist talking about that with your client? And so there's a range of, I think there's 12 different categories or umbrella terms to examine for yourself as an individual what you're comfortable with speaking about.
So tell people what happened. So this was the first thing that people ran across when they started your study, and you had a certain number of people that signed up and said, yeah, I absolutely want to do this study.
Yeah, we had about 400 respondents initially, so meaning that people logged in and said they wanted to participate and said, yes, they were a clinician. And then unknowingly, we just put this up front as the first question, what behaviors are you comfortable speaking with? And they were all listed together, all of the behaviors. And all of a sudden, we started seeing our participant numbers drop immediately after that question. So we lost about 100 participants just from being faced with the idea of a list of different kink behaviors that they might have to talk about during the study.
What did that tell you right away? Or as a researcher, do you stop yourself from?
Well, for one, it told me that we might have been going a little bit too fast with our study, that maybe we need to ease people into the dialogue. But it also told me that there is a lot of therapists out there who are uncomfortable talking about sexual behaviors, period. And some of the sexual behaviors I would consider vanilla. So talking about intercourse or masturbation. And there was a large number of people who didn't even respond that they'd be comfortable talking about those.
I want you to talk, there was something that you talked about called Multicultural Counseling Knowledge and Awareness Scale. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, so whenever you're trying to create a new scale, one of the best practices is to find other scales that might relate to it. So we were asking ourselves, what other bias scales might relate to kink bias? And so one of the things that we came up with was general cultural bias. So we had this theory that if individuals can handle cultural discussions, period, then they might be more able to handle kink conversations as well. And so we chose the MCAS, which is a multicultural scale that examines people's biases around different ethnic backgrounds. For example, do you assume that it's a sign of interpersonal connectedness when you make eye contact with somebody? And that's an assumption that many therapists have. But we know that there's cultures where it's actually appropriate not to make direct eye contact. So we studied that aside from our kink scale, so that we can norm it, is what it's called. Norming is when you see if it's validated by topics that are similar to what the topic is that you're interested in.
And I remember you all talking about the fact that you expected that people that scored high on that scale would also score high on the lovingly named Cox scale that you created. And that turned out not to be true.
Right. They scored high enough for it to be statistically significant, but not as high as we thought. And so what that told us was that kink bias is its own thing. It's not the same as general cultural bias. And that's really important because that means that other implicit bias trainings that focus on general cultural competency are not capturing the kink community. There is a need for its own training and its own implicit bias scale related to the kink community.
Well, I want to get into the analysis of this. So there were like three factors in your final results, and it was knowledge, clinical applications, and attitudes. And can you explain that to explain that to
Yeah,
us.
So knowledge is, you know, just in general, do you understand what kink is and what its purpose is? Do you know about kink? Sometimes in the kink community, you might call this being kink friendly or kink aware, right? So kink friendly is I know about kink, I'm comfortable with it, but I don't really know kink. So people who scored high in that knowledge domain, those are people who know about kink, but they're not really versed in the kink community. Then we had attitudes. These are general bias. These is more in the bias category, meaning that these would be individuals who believed that kink might be traumatizing or a sign of psychopathology. Our final category was the clinical applications. And so this is what the purpose of kink might serve within the therapeutic relationship. So one of the things that the kink guidelines found, and listeners can go to kinkguidelines.com to read all of those guidelines for therapists. And that might be a proactive way to even help your therapist start to get some education around the kink community. So clinical applications, we know that many, many people are using kink as a way to explore their gender identity, their sexual identity, and some healing opportunities as well. Kink happens in many different types of relationships, many different age ranges, and kink doesn't always have to be the therapy focus, but it might be something that's happening in the background as a means of healing.
Now, finally, I want you to really just tell people, these two groups of people that I really want to be hearing what you're saying today, what is the most important thing that you would say first to patients or clients about this
I
work?
Would say that kink behaviors have an incredible ability to be positive, a positive impact on an individual's life. And they are not a sign of psychopathology. They are not necessarily a trauma reaction. And so if you are encountered with a therapist or a medical practitioner that is trying to convince you that those are signs of psychopathology, meaning they're problem behaviors that you need to be changing, then that's a sign that you need to find a new doctor. So I just want to reiterate that there is no evidence that kink behaviors are an indicator of mental illness or a previous trauma.
And what's the most important thing you want to say to practitioners?
What I would really like clinicians to understand is that it is really important if you are working with somebody to do a sexual assessment, to ask them what kind of sexual behaviors are they wanting to address or how they might impact their relationships. This would be similar to a client comes in and you don't ask them who they're living with or who their partner is. Are they married? Are they dating someone? Do they have children? That would be what it's like to ask, to not want to talk about somebody's kink behaviors. And what we see in therapists is that sometimes they, when they're uncomfortable, they embrace what's called a neutral stance. I will listen, but I won't add. So that's like a stepping back. We're taught to do this as clinicians because it doesn't create harm. But in the kink community, it actually does create harm because of the bias against this community. So when you take a stance of neutrality, what you're actually communicating is, I don't want to hear about this. It's not valuable to the work that we're doing. And so shifting into what you're more comfortable with is communicating still something to that client. And so instead, it's going to be important to do your own work behind the scenes. One of the things that kink practitioners frequently talk about when it comes to their therapist is that they have to spend a lot of their session time educating their therapist. And that is something that should not happen. Remember that clients are paying for services or their insurance company is paying for services. And so those services should not be paid for if your client has to be educating you. That would be something that you'd want to do pro bono maybe if you really want your client to educate you on that. But ultimately, I think the responsibility lies on the practitioner. There are many, many articles out that are easy to access. And like I said, the kinkguidelines.com, that's a free source. You can go anytime. They have some wonderful resources on that page. There's many, many others. If you just do a quick Google search that are free source to learn about kink behaviors. And so when your client brings up the specific engaging behaviors that they're doing some assessment. How does that, what role does that play in your life? How is that helping or healing you? Do you think that relates to some of the issues that we're working on together and exploring that from a psychological perspective while behind the scenes doing your own work to inform yourself?
That is great. This work that you're doing is so important. And as I mentioned to you before we started talking, it is a great interest of mine as someone who really wants to focus on assisting those with disabilities and chronic illnesses to, you know, like maintain a healthy, satisfactory, enriching sex life, which can include kink sometimes. And so I was so grateful to hear you talk and really excited.
Yeah, actually 70% of individuals have kink fantasies. There's a lower amount of people who actually engage in kink behaviors, but that could be because their partner doesn't have the same fantasies as them, or they're not able to fulfill what the fantasy is. If we think about people with chronic conditions, if they have a fantasy that is something that's not physically accessible to them, then they might end up doing behaviors that don't align with what their fantasies are.
Absolutely. And, you know, I have a theory, so just in my mind, that folks with chronic conditions, which can include pain and certainly includes, an added layer of power and control struggle in your life, like with your body, with people outside you in your life, like maintaining control over your own body and your own autonomy and all of that. I think that folks with chronic conditions may even have a higher percentage of those folks.
Yeah, there was that that study that you and I were listening to that was about using BDSM practices as a way to cope with chronic pain. And I know that's a researcher you're trying to contact. Mm-hmm. But there, I read a study that was also about schemas. So schemas are our way of understanding different ideas. For example, if I say the word bird, many of you are going to think of a sparrow. Very few people think of a penguin as your schema. Okay, so that's an idea of a schema. What do you think of when you have an idea? Well, when we think of pain, frequently it comes with fear and anxiety and resistance or avoidance. And so kink behaviors are one way to create a new schema around pain that isn't so fearful and avoidant.
Dr. Brown, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me again on MS and Sex. Now, I want to first say that there were so many folks who made this study possible, so please look in the episode notes for a full list of their names. Now, it was interesting that this month it just happened that some local performers heard about me, the leather dyke me, not the sex educator me, and they asked me to do a flogging demo at a local burlesque event that was focused on queer goth kinkiness. The event was really fun, and there were some great performance artists and musicians there. I said that I would do this demo for them, but only if I could spend half my time talking about desire, consent, safety, and all that stuff. And I will say that the number of kink curious people that showed up just blew me away. Now, y'all know, I do not live in a big city. This is a pretty small town. And this story just puts an exclamation point on this episode and the fact that people are hungry for acknowledgement that their desires are normal. They want information and community and not to be shamed for who they are. So it is time for healthcare practitioners of all kinds to step up, understand their own biases so that they can truly support their patients. Now, y'all get a chance to ask these researchers some questions in a live Zoom event on October 28th at 5 p.m. Pacific time. The link to this meeting is in the episode notes on my Instagram profile at MSNSex and on the homepage of my website, which is www.msexualhealth.com. I really hope that you join us for this important conversation. So I will see you then.